sit at home late at night, using their personal servers to send out chatty emails, and then mixed with notes to friends, family, something official and classified?
I do, Bob said, his features clouding with obvious disgust at such stupidity.
Easy enough to crack if they break security protocols. Do that, and a door might be wide open for someone to snoop into. Well, we've got such a person at Bluemont.
Go on.
After taking another drink of wine, Bob put the glass down on the table next to Ernie, who did not hesitate to pour in several more precious ounces while Bob took another puff on his cigar, and John gladly inhaled next to him. The entire internet and computer security game was something he would readily admit was beyond him, so it was always fascinating to listen in on something like this. General Scales, what is Site R? John could see Bob stiffen at Linda's query.
Could you repeat that one, Linda?
Site R, and your response tells me that means something to you. There was a long moment of silence from Bob. Cigars had always been an excellent means of giving a man a moment to gather his thoughts as he appeared to examine the glowing tip, knock off a bit of ash, and take another meditative puff, which is exactly what Bob did, and it spoke volumes to John, who remained silent.
Linda, I am not sure what you are driving at, and as far as this Site R is concerned, I have no comment.
Then it's classified? Linda snapped, her voice like that of a prosecuting attorney closing in for the kill. She stood up, went over to a filing cabinet alongside Ernie's desk, pulled it open, drew out a file folder, and tossed it on Ernie's desk next to where Bob was sitting. My Site R file, General. Sorry, but our regular printer was fried off on the day. We did scrounge up an old dot matrix printer from the college library, and a couple of boxes of paper, but no extra printer cartridges. My handwritten notes. Excuse them, some people say I have a miserable left-handed scrawl. But take a look, General.
Bob picked up the file folder, opened it, and held it up close to try to read the faded printouts and all but illegible handwriting. He finally gave up and put the folder back on the table.
What are these?
She smiled, the smile of the legendary Cheshire Cat, luring by its cryptic words its prey coming in closer for the kill. We started to monitor this person over a week ago. He was breaking standard encrypting. Our profile, a bureaucrat at Bluemont. Emails bouncing all the way up to their satellite system and back down to an address at a place called Site R. Personal stuff. Hope it is his wife, rather than a girlfriend, because if it is a girlfriend and he's married, the bastard should be hanged. Some of it the usual sticky stuff. Some of it, well, all this proper Southern girl can say is it got very randy at times between the two, though that girl Samantha, who was tracking it day and night, got more than a few laughs.
Linda smiled at that, and even Ernie chuckled.
He sure is horny.
Ernie,
Linda snapped.
Well, he is. And in this starving world, you got to be damn young or very well fed to have enough surplus energy to think the way those two are. It used to be called sexting, I think.
You don't have to tell me,
Linda shot back, and Ernie visibly wilted.
Hey, let's call that TMI, John snapped, though he was now curious to look at the files as well, even though from Bob's expression it was obvious Linda had hit a major nerve at the mention of Site R.
Please continue, Bob said softly as he picked up the file folder and began to thumb through it again.
Site R, as I was saying, we wondered where it was. For all we knew, it could be some island in the Indian Ocean, England, Antarctica, and the emails just pathetic longings. But then it cracked open wider. Our horny Romeo appears to be making his plaintive cries of undying love and longing right under Juliet's balcony.
How do you know that? Bob asked.
He said he had a seat on the weekly shuttle chopper. Once things settled down, when the package was delivered, he would be able to visit her again.
Something about a 5-day personal leave, a quick flight, and plenty of time then with his lover. She replied that she is getting sick of being stuck inside R, and asked why can't she just get a posting to Bluemont, and then they could be together all the time. He then dodged off on his reply and, get this, said that no one is supposed to know that he, and I quote, got you out to safety at site R.
Bob looked at her wide-eyed, obviously taken completely off guard, and she indeed did smile openly now. Whatever her game, John realized, she had just sprung it on an obviously unsuspecting general. He opened the file folder again, held up the pages closely, and started to scan through them one by one. Cursing softly, he reached into his breast pocket to produce a pair of reading glasses, put them on, and for long minutes scanned through the files. All were silent. Ernie puffed on his cigar, and after draining the precious glass of Malbec, without offering to those around him, he pulled out the nearly empty bottle of brandy, poured a stiff drink, and swiftly downed it, earning a sharp glance from Linda. Bob finally put the file back down with a sigh. "Damn all to hell," he whispered, and he held his empty glass up for Ernie to reluctantly refill with what was left in the brandy bottle and took it all down in a couple of quick gulps. "Can I keep this file?" he asked. Linda shook her head.
"If it's as important as I think it now is, the answer is no."
"And if I just take it?"
"You don't leave here if you try."
He nodded, looking over at John. "You reason with her. I want this file. I need this file." There was an urgency to Bob's appeal that spoke volumes to John, who wordlessly gave an appealing look to Linda. She was silent for a moment, considering her answer.
"I assume John is under arrest and going with you, General Scales."
Bob, who was leaning over toward Ernie, who was relighting his cigar, looked back at Linda. "Yes, he is, but don't tell your family and the students hear that. We don't need a scene."
"John?"
She looked at him sharply. He realized all he had to do was announce he had no intentions of going, and all in this house would resist his leaving and, if need be, hold Scales as hostage.
"Give the file to me, Linda," John said. "You can trust me with it."
"Bob, can I take responsibility for the file?" Scales nodded in ready agreement. John reached over to pick it up without waiting for her reply and then turned his gaze back to her.
"All right, John."
Her voice was choked with emotion. "Thank you, ma'am," Bob said, and setting his glass down, he swiftly stood up. Linda stood up and went up to John and hugged him.
"When do I see you again, John Matherson?" "Don't worry, just keep everyone here safe."
She started to stifle back tears. Bob reached out to put a reassuring hand on her shoulder.
"Ma'am, you just might have changed the paradigm. I hope you can trust me."
She looked back at him sharply.
"I don't."
"I can understand that."
"Anything you wish to smash on your way out?" she asked sarcastically.
He did not reply, leaving their office, slowly walking out into the large room dubbed the Skunk Works, and then turning to look back at the three who were following him.
"Keep this up and running. Focus on this. How did you put it, Ernie? This horny Romeo? Focus in on him with everything you have."
Linda and Ernie looked at him with obvious surprise.
"As far as your team knows, they are being shut down. Find whoever is your loud-mouthed ham operator. For that matter, all your ham operators, and I want them off the air now immediately. I want a full shutdown on any kind of uplink traffic. Silent listening only. Nothing even on the phone line. I'll have a courier down here tomorrow to pick up anything new, but it will be made to look like he is occupying this place and shutting it down. Do you read me?"
Those last four words were spoken sharply in a clear command voice that carried the type of threat a general knew how to conjure up when need be. Ernie and Linda stood silent, just nodding in reply, until Linda broke the silence.
"And John's fate?"
"He is still under arrest and will face charges in Bluemont,"
Bob said sharply, loudly enough that the eavesdroppers gathered in the living room below could obviously hear. Shouts of protest rose up as family and former students gathered at the base of the stairwell as the four came back down. Bob made a show of shouldering his way through, ignoring the curses and threats hurled at him, John following in his wake, shrugging off more than one plaintive attempt at a hug and appeals for him to stay. Though the climb up to the home had been a laborious one, Bob descended the driveway at a near run, John following in his wake. Whatever it was that had so hit the general, it was obviously big. And not another word was said as he approached the waiting helicopter, its turbines kicking over as he approached. John hesitated to climb in. He could not help but sense that doing so was sealing his fate for whatever was ahead. Bob climbed into the chopper, the rotors overhead beginning to turn, and looked back at John.
"Matherson, you can turn and run, and I won't follow.
That or get your ass in here now and face what is coming next. It's your call."
Wondering if he would ever see Michaela and his newborn child, he hesitated for several seconds, and then climbed in after Bob, and the Black Hawk lifted off. Chapter 14. He didn't feel free, or that he was actually under close arrest. After landing at the Asheville airport, Bob had disappeared into the cavernous hangar that had once housed National Guard aircraft at the north end of the airport, while John was led to what had been the headquarters for a couple of private aviation firms. Bunks had been set up in the foyer and corridors to house troops, some of them fast asleep. Those relaxing off duty and still awake gazed at him with curiosity, but said nothing as a sergeant major led John to what had been a private office, desk pushed to one side, a standard collapsible bunk with sleeping bags set up in its place. The sergeant told him to wait for a moment and returned with a sleeping bag and an MRE-supplied cup of instant coffee, which John took a sip of and set down. It was laced with whiskey, and for the time being he definitely wanted to keep his head clear. "Anything you need, sir, on bunk next door, just come and get me." "Mind if I wander about a bit, sergeant?" His voice trailed off, the middle-aged man's name tag concealed under his parka. "It's Sergeant Major Charles Bentley, sir. Just call me Charles or Sarge, okay?" "Fine, Sergeant. About wandering around?"
"Sorry, sir, but you are under arrest until I hear differently. I'm responsible for your well-being. Play along, and we keep it as it is now. You try to walk off, sir, and sorry to say it, I will have to put you under restraint. Those are the general's orders."
"I won't be a cause for concern, Sergeant," John said, as he turned to look out through the half-open Venetian blinds. A couple of dozen private planes were still out there. Bonanzas, Moonies, the usual Cherokee 140s and 180s, Cessna 172s that must have belonged to the flight school, and even some high-end turboprops on a couple of corporate jets, all of them abandoned. Long ago, he had sent a crew down here to drain off their avgas and Jet A, but even before his people had arrived, looters had already been at the planes, taking all the gas and, most likely just for the hell of it, smashing them up. The planes, once worth millions, had all been pushed to one side to make room for the 8 Black Hawks, 6 Apaches, and a C-130, and as he watched, a second C-130 was taxiing in from landing. "Is that everything you have, Sergeant?" John asked.
"You know I can't answer that, sir."
"John is okay with me.
Sir, orders from the general are to consider you as a colonel reactivated to service, so it remains sir or colonel."
"All right, Sergeant. Mind if I ask a few questions?"
"Those I can answer fine by me, sir."
"Been with General Scales long?"
"I'm his top enlisted aide. After Major Quentin left, I've been his sole adjutant."
"Can you tell me anything about Major Quentin?" The sergeant politely shook his head in reply. "He left us with a hell of a mystery, Sergeant. This talk about an EMP.
You know anything about that?"
"Sir, you know as well as I do what I can and cannot answer." John smiled, pulled out one of the chairs stacked up in the corner of the room, and sat down, taking off his parka, stretching his legs out to relax, and making a show of just sipping the whiskey-laced coffee but not gulping it down.
"Sergeant, how about sitting down for a few minutes? I'd appreciate the company."
"Sir, you are bunked in the same room as the general. When he comes back, perhaps it would be better to direct your questions at him."
The man was good.
firm without being disrespectful, and he would stick to his orders. Perhaps one of them to get John a bit tipsy and pump him, or even to see if he could be made tipsy. With that thought, John made a show of going over to the window, cracking it open and pouring out the laced coffee. He looked back at the sergeant, who actually grinned a bit. Waste of a good drink, sir. I prefer to keep my head on straight, here and then wherever it is you are eventually taking me. If there's nothing else, sir, I'll be next door down. The sergeant turned to leave. Charlie. The sergeant looked back. At least tell me about yourself. Were you in the Pentagon on the day the shit hit the fan? No, sir, I was actually part of the ceremonial team at Fort Meade for duty at Arlington. Final assignment before mustering out after 25 years. The sergeant's trim but muscular build, ramrod straight posture, and demeanor was a giveaway to John. The ceremonial guard was one of the most exacting assignments in the military. It was not just the very public task of standing guard at the tomb of the unknown soldier, but also for all military funerals, and beyond that any ceremonial event requiring military presence in D.C. itself. Behind the scenes, it was also a highly efficient combat force, one of the top ready reaction forces inside the Beltway. How did you meet General Scales? He and some others from the Pentagon came in the evening of the first day. He seemed reticent to continue. And then? Well, the general and I sort of fell in together, and he asked me to stick with him. Mind if you tell me more about what happened in D.C. that first day, Sergeant? No, sir. There was a lot of confusion. The whole city was down, communications down. By the middle of the first night, the city was burning. Again, there was a drawn-out silence. He was obviously reluctant to say more. Nothing classified, just curious, John prompted him. After a couple of days, it was obvious to some we were doing nothing effective where we were. Some said we should try to link up with Andrews Air Force Base, but that was on the other side of the city, and we hadn't seen any air traffic, at least not going out from there. That struck John as curious. Did you see air traffic? He asked. Yes, sir. A number of choppers looked like special ops-type equipment, most likely proofed against EMPs. They were moving about. So something was at least flying. Yes, sir. But nothing toward us. All our comm gear was down, and we were obviously written off. What were these choppers doing? Where were they going? Don't know, sir. He replied a bit too hastily. John knew the sergeant would not speculate anything with him and dropped that line of questioning. So you then went to Andrews? No, sir. A group did set out that way. The sergeant smiled. A lot of those wandering in from the Pentagon were men like General Scales. Well, I should say around the same rank. There was a lot of arguing back and forth, which I stayed clear of. Smart move, Sergeant. If two generals got into a row, I always made myself scarce. The general said we should strike out for Fort Belvoir and link up with whatever was there. Most of us went along with him. Most? Well, sir, it did get a bit ugly. Not often you see a two-star telling a couple of three-stars to go to hell. The general, he had a hell of a lot more ground experience, not a paper pusher. We could see that and went with him. Good analysis and smart move. I understand you served under him, sir. At last, a question back. And John openly went over the times they served together, even how when he had decided to retire because of Mary's cancer, it was Bob who had helped him find a position at Montreat College, which was Mary's hometown. The sergeant took it in, most likely not much that was new there if his job was to pump John as a good cop interrogator. Sergeant, you have family? And now the man did stiffen up. Yes, sir. And? I'd rather not talk about it. I understand. The general told me about what most likely happened to his wife. There was a momentary pause again. They lived on the other side of the Potomac. My wife, two daughters, a son. My boy was a plebe up at West Point. My daughter's still in high school. I didn't want them in some crap hole of a school in Washington, unless you were able to pay $40,000 apiece to send your kids to one of the schools where all the elites were sending theirs, you were stuck. I had in-laws up near College Park, good schools at least up there, so that's where we bought a small, very overpriced house to ensure the kids were safe and at a good school. Again a moment of silence. I wanted to try to get to them. The general talked me out of it. I guess he was right. One man alone trying to get through all that chaos. It was something I would think about at times before the day. You know, trying to plan what to do if everything ever hit the fan. But you know how it was, sir. It was always figuring 10, maybe 20 megatons on Washington, an equal dose on Baltimore. 1 minute we're here, the next we're together with a lot of other poor souls waiting to talk to God. You know what I mean. John could see that the mere recollection was painful. All the worst nightmares possible most likely kept him up night after night. No quick, near-instant deaths. A woman with 2 teenage daughters. What chance did they have? And the sergeant knew it. John decided to tell him a bit about Jennifer. A choice to perhaps share a bit of the misery to help bond. The sergeant listened sympathetically.
At least you were with her at the end, sir.
Yes, I'm grateful for that. Also the most painful moment of my life, but yes, at least grateful that I know what happened, unlike you in General Scales. Does he ever talk about it? Again a moment of silence.
Some nights I can hear him praying about her, that's all I'll say.
I understand. It was obvious the sergeant was not going to offer more. He did try, a bit woodenly, to ask about what assets John had, even as to where the Black Hawk was stashed, to which John just smiled politely and replied that he'd prefer not to answer. The sergeant finally relented and stood up to leave. Sergeant, as he spoke up, John held his coffee cup back up. Can I hit you up for another cup? This time straight, no cream, no whiskey, no Xanax, okay? The sergeant smiled. Sure thing. He returned a moment later with a steaming cup and a plastic MRE pouch filled with hot stew. John took both gratefully. Again, sir, no wandering about or talking with other personnel. If I have your word of honor, I'll leave the door unlocked. There's a bathroom down the hall. We managed to get water running for the toilets, but no hot water yet. I'll loan you a razor, soap, and a heat packet from an MRE for shaving if you want. I'd appreciate that, Sergeant. I really would. Several minutes later, he was in the bathroom looking into a mirror, as always, shocked by his appearance. It seemed he had aged 10 years in the past 2. His hair, cut short, had gone nearly entirely gray. The rough stubble of a beard actually was looking white, his features gaunt, eyes a bit sunken, complexion sallow. It was the look of his world, again reminding him of photographs of long ago, the aged and chiseled features of boys in their early 20s after a couple of years with the Army of the Potomac, having survived Antietam and Gettysburg and all wars since. The sergeant came in, offering over a disposable razor that looked fresh, a small, still-wrapped packet of soap, a small toothbrush with a travel-sized tube of pre-war paste, and a plastic MRE bag, its chemical charge having been activated, and the pint of water within hot to the touch. John thanked him with genuine gratitude. For the first time in more than 2 years, he was no longer struggling with an old-fashioned straight razor. He splashed some of the scalding hot water onto his face, opened up the soap pack, rubbed it onto the stubble, dipped the razor into the hot water, and began to shave. When he turned on the faucet, a trickle of rusty-colored cold water dripped out. Several nicks, and a lot of scratching later, he looked back up at his red-faced image in the mirror. "Well, if they are going to shoot me," he thought, "at least I'll look halfway decent." The bag of water was still hot, and on impulse, even though the room was freezing cold, he stripped off his heavy flannel shirt and sweat-encrusted undershirt, leaned over the sink, poured several ounces of the water on his head, and scrubbed a bit with the small bar of soap, his short hair so oily he barely worked up a lather. Alternating between the freezing cold water and what was left of the warm water in the bag, he rinsed most of the soap out. How he longed for a full shower, but the building was without heat, and at least he now felt semi-civilized as he pulled the graying T-shirt back on and heavy flannel shirt over it. He finished up by brushing his teeth with real toothpaste. a heavenly feeling after 2 years of charcoal mixed with mint leaves. Coming out of the room, he found the sergeant loitering in the hall, and thanking him, John handed the razor back, the sergeant motioning for him to keep the small bar of soap, toothpaste, and brush. He realized the sergeant had shown a subtle act of trust. Even though it was a modern, disposable razor, a desperate man could still cut his wrists with it, an act unthinkable to a man like John, and the sergeant knew that.
"You almost look like an officer again," the sergeant said, offering a smile. "Don't let your stew chill down. The coffee has nothing in it. Chances are, when the general finishes up with whatever it is that bit him in the butt, he'll want to talk to you."
"So you wanted me to look good and well-fed before the execution, is that it, Sergeant?" John said it as a joke, but saw that it had misfired.
"The general follows the rules, sir, same as me, and I believe you as well. In his eyes, you are a standing officer in the American Army. There will be no summary execution, sir. You will have a proper court-martial. Yes, we executed some in Richmond and Roanoke, and that was for the same kinds of crimes you faced with that posse group. So, sir."
And his voice now took on a harsh warning edge.
"Do not insult General Scales in my presence, sir, by implying he would act in any way contrary to the Articles of War."
John admired this type of loyalty and extended his hand in an offer of apology, which the sergeant, going formal, did not at first return. "Sergeant Major, I hold the general in the same respect as you do. I know I am under arrest by orders from Bluemont, not by the generals."
"I suggest you get some rest, sir," the sergeant said.
He drew back and offered a salute, which John formally returned. "Thank you for your help." He paused, continuing to hold the man's gaze. "And my sympathy regarding your family, regarding all our families, including that of General Scales." There seemed to be a flash of easing down on the sergeant's part. He nodded and turned away while John went back to his assigned quarters. The stew was barely lukewarm. He downed it hungrily, gulped the black coffee, unrolled the sleeping bag the sergeant had provided, and, in spite of what he figured was his condemned status, he was asleep within minutes.
"All right, Colonel Matherson, out of that sack and on your feet."
Momentarily confused, John sat up. How long he had been asleep, he wasn't sure. It was dark outside. Scales, standing over him holding a Coleman lantern that was hissing loudly, turned up to full illumination. John sat up, rubbing his chin, surprised with the realization that he was freshly shaved and his mouth did not feel sticky and taste rancid. Scales set the lantern down on the table, pushed to the corner of the room, pulled a chair behind it, and placed another across from him, motioning for John to sit down.
"I trust Sergeant Bentley saw to your needs and treated you well."
"A good man. You know how to pick them, sir."
"Fine. He told me you behaved okay. No tricks and kept to the code, not revealing anything. Sorry about lacing that coffee with whiskey. In part, it was to get you to just relax, but yeah, we both know it's an old trick."
"Figured that one, of course, though it was tempting. So, when does the court-martial start? Or are you really transporting me up to Bluemont for trial?" Bob sighed, leaned back in his chair, and rubbed his eyes.
"You got a good 8 hours of sleep, John. I've been at it nonstop since midnight, and it's just past 6 here."
John waited for him to continue.
"We've orders to pull back to Roanoke, and before we leave to take down everything you have here."
Even as he spoke, John glanced out the window and saw that several floodlights, powered by a loud generator, had been set up around the perimeter where the Blackhawks and Apaches were parked, crews busily at work. "And that is it?" John said coldly. "Why?"
"Those were my orders, and don't you dare to try to throw the line at me about only following orders."
He knew better than to do so, and raised that infamous moral argument.
"The attack we were supposed to be staging for to move on Atlanta has been put on hold. We don't have the assets to do it."
"Bob, if what I see parked outside is everything you've got, there is no way in hell you're ever going to secure Atlanta."
"What I was trying to tell them all along. I actually did pass up what you suggested. Of course, you can understand I did not peg your name to it. That we need to sit back through the rest of the winter at least, let them tough it out a while longer,
and perhaps be more tractable come spring. They weren't happy up in Bluemont with that. They tried to push it. I said it was impossible, and they just got back to me to pull back to Roanoke, but to take down whatever you've built here first.
It means they're going to do it. They're going to pop an EMP. That's the real reason they want you to give up what you've just gained.
Bob looked over at him and said nothing. Anything else? John asked. Again, silence.
I assume I go with you.
Something like that.
That's what I figured.
Bob went up and looked out the window as a Black Hawk's engine started to turn over, was revved up for a minute, and then shut down. A light snow was falling, and once out of the sleeping bag, John could feel that the temperature in the room had dropped by quite a few degrees.
Among everything else, John, the fact that you were still alive and managed to dodge that hit squad has made life even more complex.
So it was Bluemont?
Bob simply nodded.
You suspected they would pull it. That was what you were warning me about.
You twisted a lot of tails up there, the way you took out Fredericks and then several days later talked with the BBC about it. They had to brand you as an out-of-control terrorist.
He sighed.
And yes, I had orders to summarily execute you as a renegade. I didn't dare to try to contact you directly with a warning. There is someone in your ranks that was infiltrated in, most likely by Fredericks, who I guess gave a GPS of your house and your routine. I was able to bullshit my way around that you had slipped by me and that trying to take you out would trigger a full-scale riot. So they decided to act on their own with, as used to be said, extreme prejudice.
John took all that in, and there was an inward relief at last. He believed him,
or at least for now. And a huge subtext as well, John. They hit you, everyone will believe I did it, and it will trigger a regular civil war. It was a stab at me as well.
Again he sighed and looked down at the floor.
One of the final acts that is triggering what happens next.
Bob stood, went back to his bunk, opened a briefcase, and pulled out what John recognized as an aviation map. Bob spread it out on the desk, anchored one corner with the Coleman lantern, and just stared at it for a moment.
So in your service, you never heard of Site R?
It's someplace out in Nevada, isn't it? John asked, but then he paused as Bob placed an old-style aviation slide rule on the map. The circular part was mounted in the middle of a rectangular sheet of metal, a foot long and 4 inches wide, one side hashed off with lines like a ruler, which John recalled could be used to measure distances on an aviation map. Bob was not trying to hide anything as John came around the table to look over Bob's shoulder. John could see lines already penciled in, originating in Asheville, and then tracing north by northeast. He leaned closer. To an untrained eye, the map was a nearly insane jumble of circles, numbers, and symbols for airports, some surrounded with air-control demarcation zones, the surface color shaded to indicate ground altitudes, inverted V-like symbols of such obstacles as antennas. He focused his attention on the penciled lines that crossed into an area bound by Washington, D.C. on one side and extending westward for a considerable distance, all of it colored over in light gray. Bob saw where John was focusing his attention. All that gray area was heavily restricted to air traffic, even more so after 9/11. It is just under 350 air miles from here. John followed the line that Bob now traced out on the map and then looked up at him in surprise.
My birds down there have an operational radius of just under 350 miles. I'm having my people mount some extra fuel tanks to extend that. It is eating up nearly every gallon I have left. We're lifting off in a couple of hours.
He looked over again at John.
You're going with me.
To hand over to Bluemont?
Bob glared at him. I'm leaving some of my personnel behind for this. It will be a hand-picked team that goes with me. I don't think I need to tell you when it comes to really trusting everyone who is with me in this command. I know who I can count on, who might hesitate, and some just might jump the other way. My Major Manetti is one of them, so he stays behind. I can carry 90 with me in the Blackhawks.
He continued to stare at John.
I want you to pick half a dozen of yours to go with us.
In heaven's name, why?
So they can be executed too? I want them as witnesses, Bob replied sharply, obviously insulted by John's accusatory response. I want civilian witnesses who are about to learn the truth. I want you to pick six people that you trust.
And that means trusting you, General.
Yes, it does. Again, I leave the decision to you.
Bob turned away and looked out the window.
You can walk out of here now and no one will stop you. I publicly arrested you to protect you, because I had orders to either give you a speedy trial and execution or take you to Bluemont for the same. I am not going to do that. I had reason to believe another unit might be sent to visit you, or for that matter, just drop a fuel-air bomb on that beautiful valley of Montreat to finish it, and let me take the blame. Arresting you as I did bought a little extra time, but Bluemont is expecting me to deliver you alive or dead before the day is out. Knowing that, you are free to go if that is your decision, but get your people evacuated now, today.
Or what, sir?
This morning my ass is on the line as well. I'll explain it later, but things with Bluemont have never been a love match from the start. Of late have gone very sour, and you, Colonel Matherson, you and your friends have finally pushed me over the edge.
Which means?
Your call, John. If you don't trust me with this, and suspect I am playing some game to deliver not just you but six of your friends to Bluemont as icing on the cake, then get the hell out of here now. If you trust me, I want six of your best with me within 2 hours. I want them as additional witnesses as to what is going to happen next. When all is said and done this day, many might not believe me, but they just might believe you and your friends.
John again looked at the map. He was not sure exactly what it was that Bob was plotting, but it was not what he expected just 12 hours ago when arrested.
Okay, sir, was all he could say in reply. Across a lifetime, he had learned that far too often when someone said, "Just trust me," it was a prequel to getting a knife in the back. Bob was asking him now to not just put his own life on the line, but those of some of his closest friends and comrades as well. But there was a cold logic to it all at this moment. If they were about to be betrayed, Bob's prediction that Bluemont would take his community off the map with an air attack was undoubtedly true, and his friends would die anyhow. He again looked at the lines Bob had drawn on the map, what it implied, and he finally made the decision. If Bob's intent was to betray them, they were all dead anyhow. If not, he would have to trust his old commander's offer.
Okay, sir. I'll give them a call, but chances are they'll refuse.
I won't blame them if they do, but I sure would appreciate their presence this day. I can have a Bradley up there in an hour to pick them up and bring them back. I hope they sign on.
John looked at the map one more time, still not sure where this was all leading. Some pieces were beginning to fall into place, memories surfacing from his time at the War College and a stint in the Pentagon. I'll make the call.
Chapter 15. John climbed into the troop compartment of the Black Hawk and looked across to the opposite row of benches. Maury, Grace, Forrest Burnett, Reverend Black, and Kevin Milady seemed relatively at ease, but Lee was already cursing under his breath while Maury helped him to adjust his safety straps. They had all been rousted out by his call to the town office. By chance, Forrest had come in from over the mountain when hearing that John had been arrested, demanding to lead a rescue operation before he was hauled away. The fact that all of them had actually trusted his voice, over a phone, to board a Bradley sent up from the airport, and that it was not a trap to round up those who had served with him, spoke volumes. The door was about to be slid shut when, to John's surprise, Bob Scales climbed in, followed by Sergeant Major Bentley and a young staff sergeant toting several different radios. Behind them, extra boxes of small-caliber ammunition were loaded in, finally followed by a medic dragging aboard a couple of boxes of medical supplies. The pilot looked back over his shoulder.
Sir, we are overweight, he shouted. Just get us the hell up, burn off some gas, and we'll be fine, Bob shouted back. I've seen worse. Your orders, sir, the pilot snapped back.
Bob looked around at John's friends and smiled.
So I suppose you're all wondering why I asked for this meeting at 8 in the morning with the snow coming down.
You're damn straight,
Forrest muttered, and he finally added on,
Sir.
Time later. Now just enjoy the ride. I always get a kick out of liftoff.
The 8 Black Hawks and 6 Apaches started to taxi out from the parking area in front of the National Guard hangar, ground crews watching them, bundled up against the blasts of the rotors and the moderate snow coming in from the west. Rather than do a straight vertical takeoff, they actually taxied down to the end of the runway, the lead Apache turning to face the wind, and with wheels still on the ground, built up forward speed before finally nosing up. John looked forward through the windshield of the Black Hawk to watch the show. Forrest was leaning up out of his seat to watch as well and started to chuckle.
Remember that damn movie? The one with the bugler blowing charge? We actually used to do that in the stand if a bunch of us were lifting off and going in harm's way. Got your blood up.
Shut the hell up, Lee muttered, already clutching his vomit bag.
If I'd known this involved another flight, John, I'd have told you to screw off.
3 Apaches lifted off first, and then circled high to protect the rest of the formation. The Black Hawks were next. John's pilot shouted a warning to hang on. He rolled forward at full throttle, shifted the collective, and nosed up high, Lee moaning as they lifted into the swirling snow. Gaining just a few hundred feet, they leveled off and turned to a nearly due north heading.
"It's going to be nap of the earth most of the way," Scales shouted. "Might get bumpy at times with this weather. We're going to follow Interstate 26 over the mountains, angle east once through the pass until we pick up Interstate 81, and then straight on from there. Low and fast. Should take about 2.5 hours. We've got a hot thermos of coffee for those who want it. Otherwise, just settle back, try to get some sleep, and enjoy the ride."
His words were met by a heavy retching from Lee, and there were a few gags from the others, until the slipstream, shrieking past the helicopter, whipped the stench away. There had been a barrage of questions from John's friends as they wearily alighted from the Bradley at 8 in the morning and were handed Kevlar vests, helmets, M4s, and combat packs. The situation was not helped when Lee saw that they were being shepherded to a Black Hawk, its engines already running. Maury started to shout questions at John about what was going on and where they were headed as the chopper leveled off. John pleaded real ignorance as to what was transpiring, and all looked to Bob, who remained mum. The group settled into sullen silence as they raced north, interrupted only by Lee's pathetic heaves. The medic finally plastered an anti-nausea patch behind his ear and gave him a couple of pills to swallow, and just as they were clearing the top of the I-26 pass at the Tennessee border, Lee finally settled down thanks to the medication and drifted off to sleep. John sat lost in silent contemplation. He was putting one hell of a lot of trust in Bob at this moment, trusting not just for himself, but for the lives of his closest friends on the line as well. The penciled lines on the map, whatever they meant, could have been just an elaborate ruse to lull him into belief and ultimately to lure in his best combat leaders and closest friends, one of them the only man in their whole community who could, in a clumsy way, actually fly a Black Hawk, for Bob to personally deliver them to his leaders in Bluemont, the murderers of their precious Fredericks, would be quite the coup. He looked over at Bob, who, like any old hand with likely thousands of hours in Black Hawks, had settled into his bucket seat, stretched out his feet, lowered his head, and simply dozed off. There was precious little to see out of the frost and snow-covered side windows. Up front, the view was just a blur of snow and glimpses of a deadly, still interstate highway as the chopper banked to a northeasterly heading with Interstate 81 on their left. John caught a glimpse of what looked like an abandoned airport, its snow-covered runway running parallel to the interstate. John had a flash of memory. It might have been Mountain Empire Airport. He recalled it as a friendly place when several years back he was up with a friend in an Urcoupe, and they landed to get gas and some coke and crackers. One of the mechanics noted that a cowling flap had cracked loose on the antique plane. It looked to John that the bent-back metal from the cowling could mean they would be stuck for hours. The mechanic simply bolted it back in place and literally charged them just $1.50 for the bolt. He hoped that whoever had helped them had survived, and that he was perhaps peering out with envy at the 8 Black Hawks and 6 Apaches racing by, just barely above the pavement. Time stretched out, John nodding off as well after the tension of the last few days. As he was stirring awake, he saw Grace and Kevin sharing a joke and laughing, leaning in close against each other. The way they looked at each other, he wondered if something was developing between the two. If so, good. They'd make a fine match. John dozed off again, to be awakened by Bob talking to the pilot and then looking back to John.
"We just lost one of our Apaches. Turbine overheating. They're landing on the highway. See if they figure it out, but we're pushing on."
"Where are we?"
John asked. "Near Winchester, Virginia. It really is nap of the earth now, so you'd all better hang on for this last part."
Winchester? If so, John knew that Bluemont was just 15 or so miles to the east, dug into the slope of the Blue Ridge Mountains, which too many mistakenly called the Shenandoahs. If they continued on the current heading, it really did mean Bob was not heading there after all.
"How far to wherever it is we are going?" John asked. 15 minutes by air at most, but if Robert E. Lee was leading us as infantry," he said, smiling, "it'd be about 2 days' forced march."
It took a minute to decipher that, and John smiled. His last remaining doubts had just been set aside. The helicopter flared 15 minutes later, as Bob predicted, nose high, coming into land, snow swirling up around it, nearly blinding the view. John looked out eagerly. He recognized the terrain as if it were darn near his own hometown. The chopper, nose into the wind, thumped down a bit hard, bounced, and then finally settled. Bob, unstrapped from his safety harness, was already up. He hunched over, went to the side door, slid it open, and then leaped out. Typical Bob, John thought. First one in with boots on the ground. John eagerly followed him. Bob shaded his eyes against the rotor blasts as one helicopter after another settled down along the road, doors sliding open, troops leaping out with weapons raised. John looked over at Bob.
"Why land here?" he shouted. Bob grinned at him. "Because I missed the place."
John could only shake his head in wonder. Bob called over one of his captains and shouted some orders. The captain nodded and turned to issue a command, and nearly all the troops dismounted, spreading out to form a defensive perimeter, except for one squad, two of the men toting sniper rifles, another what looked to be a ground-to-air missile, and two others backpacking heavy loads that John could not identify.
"Care to come along?" Bob shouted to John. "You're damn straight I'm coming along. Mind if my friends join in?"
Bob looked back at the Black Hawk they had been on, John's people tentatively climbing out, all of them with looks of confusion, Lee obviously unhappy, until he looked around, eyes going wide before he ran a dozen yards forward to look up at a road sign.
"My God!" Lee cried. "Taneytown Road and Wheatfield Road! You have got to be kidding me!" "No joke," Bob replied. "Care to follow me?" "You're damn straight, sir," Lee shouted,
and it was he who eagerly broke the trail with his towering bulk, heading up the Wheatfield Road, plowing through the snow, which at places was drifted nearly 2 feet deep, clearing the way. Behind him, the two snipers, both men nearly as big as Lee, followed, kicking snow aside, obviously laboring to clear a path for General Scales, who, though obviously enthusiastic and eager to go, nevertheless was a man well into his 60s. And after 5 minutes of uphill ascent, it was apparent the hike was beginning to take its toll. They reached the intersection with Sykes Avenue, where Lee had paused, looking back almost like an eager child ready to push on whether the adults were following or not. Bob nodded and pointed south, a steep ascent even on days when the road and hiking path beside it were cleared of snow. John paused at the intersection, waiting for General Scales to come up, the man bending double for a moment to catch his breath. While waiting for him to continue, John took in the view, limited for a moment, as a snow squall swirled around them and then opening back up again. It truly did take his breath away, and he felt a surge of emotion.
"Let's go,"
Bob announced between hard gasps for air. "Maybe wait a few minutes, sir. Catch your breath," John offered.
Go to hell, Matherson. I can still hack it,
the general replied.
General Warren and a lot of others did it on the run, with full gear. Then there was that artillery battery, manhandling their guns up this slope as well.
And they were in their teens and twenties, John replied cautiously. Bob smiled at him, and then, without another word, pushed forward. John noticed that the two snipers had held back a bit, and were obviously working hard to tramp down the snow to form a path, as was Sergeant Major Bentley, who came along, invited or not. He had to be by his general's side. None spoke to the general or dared to offer a hand, but it was obvious they were keeping a sharp eye on him as they climbed the last few hundred yards up the steep slope. John, walking by his side, found even he was breathing hard, a memory flooding back of when he was a boy and had actually run up this hill in his eagerness to reach the crest. And indeed, there was the crest just ahead, crowned by an iconic statue. Bob was breathing so hard it started to worry John as they came nearly to the crest and turned off onto a walking path that wove its way through the heavy boulders. Lee was already up atop one of the boulders, shading his eyes against the wind, looking west.
"Down there, straight down there, one of my great-great-grandfathers came in with Hood's division."
Then he swung his arm to the northwest.
"Another one of my great-great-granddads was in the thick of it up there by the seminary on the first day."
Lee's voice thickened.
"My God, on the third day he went in with Pettigrew and lost his arm. Oh, my God!"
He turned away and tears flowed.
"Why did you bring us here?"
Lee asked of Bob, who smiled. John was brimming with the same question, having recognized where they were within seconds of touching down. They had landed behind Little Round Top on the battlefield of Gettysburg. Bob motioned for all to gather round, unable to speak for a moment, still breathing hard, coughing and spitting.
"It sucks to get old, gentlemen. My first time here, I was 12 and ran my parents into the ground."
John was smiling and nodding as his mentor spoke.
"Colonel Matherson and I must have hiked, or should I admit, driven it, a dozen or more times together for staff rides, while we were at the War College up in Carlisle, which is only 30 or so miles off that way."
He pointed to the north.
"I'm not getting it, sir," Kevin Milady said. "I've always wanted to visit this place, but why now?"
Bob turned and pointed out toward the west.
"Site R is over there," he announced. "That is why we are here, gentlemen."
"Site R?" Lee asked, but it all came to John in a stunning rush of realization. When Linda had first mentioned it, that they were monitoring some personal traffic back and forth from a Site R, it had not registered with John since he had assumed it was some government site out west. It wasn't until he saw the lines drawn on Bob's map that it finally had clicked. It explained why Bob had put a full clampdown on everyone in his command as to their destination, and why he had made some obvious choices to leave certain personnel behind, while letting it appear he was personally delivering John to Bluemont and asking some of John's team to come along as well. To throw off anyone within his own command who might squeal to Bluemont after he lifted off, the game of luring in some of John's top people to be handed over as well hopefully worked. Bluemont was far behind them now, and Gettysburg 60 miles farther on, as Bob adroitly put it, a few days' march away for Robert E. Lee. Site R was not much more than 6 miles away from where they now stood, and clearly visible from Gettysburg's Little Round Top.
"Site R was built back in the early 1950s, Bob began, and John smiled.
It was almost like the start of one of his lectures delivered at the War College.
"It was built as the fallback position for the Pentagon and civilian government in case of nuclear war. At the time it was built, the thinking was that the commies..."
He paused with an ironic smile.
"Excuse me, I mean our good friends the Russians. If they launched an attack, it would come in with bombers and we'd have 6 to 8 hours advance warning. So the military decided they needed a bunker. A damn big bunker to house upward of 25,000 personnel. It had to be far enough away from D.C.
not to be caught in the blast radius of a 20-megaton warhead and the resulting fallout, but close enough that it could be reached by ground within 2 hours, by air within 20 minutes. Thus, Site R. That's why a modern 4-lane highway was built from D.C. to Frederick, Maryland, back in the 1950s. Convenient as well that, with Eisenhower as president, it was damn near in his backyard with his farm just down there on the other side of Seminary Ridge. Whenever things were looking hairy, Ike could always just go to his farm for a while without triggering a panic and be just a few minutes away from the biggest shelter in the country. Same with Camp David, less than 5 minutes airtime away from here.
As he spoke, almost like a tour guide, he pointed to the west, but for the moment the snow squalls obscured the view. "All the times I was visiting here, I never knew about it," Lee offered.
"Well, it was kind of a secret that wasn't a secret. Impossible to hide something like that, not like some of the sites out west. It's just we never talked about it. Even with officers getting trained up at Carlisle, just 30 miles from here. Anyhow, work crews that had been drilling all the tunnels for the Pennsylvania Turnpike, coal miners from the fields north of here, a couple of thousand of them were brought in and hollowed out an entire mountain. I've been in it. You go down half a mile deep, a regular 3-lane highway, and come out into subterranean caverns that just seem to go on forever. They put up hundreds of recycled World War II barracks, officers' quarters, rather nice private trailers for high-ranked civilians, mess halls, a giant cistern fed by artesian wells, storage areas, years' worth of survival food, and a meeting room that looks like it came straight out of that movie Dr. Strangelove. It's something like a time capsule down there, actually. I was part of an emergency evacuation drill back when the Cold War was still on, but winding down. Of course we all thought it absurd. It wouldn't be bombers hitting us anymore. It would be sub-launched ballistic missiles from off the coast, launched to impact on D.C., little more than 5 minutes.
He laughed, sadly, shaking his head.
During that surprise drill, just herding us onto the buses took an hour before we were even out of the parking lot. Your typical snafu, kind of sad and creepy. Actually, how we laughed about it on the drive up here. At least it was an overnight away from the Pentagon.
When was it still operational? Maury asked.
I think that exercise we were in proved how futile it all was. If the shit hit the fan without warning, we were all toast, so why sweat it? Got mothballed back when everyone was told the Cold War was over. Rumor is it was reactivated and the vice president was parked in there for a while immediately after 9/11. But since then,
he sighed and shrugged.
I know this. On the day, there was no mention of it whatsoever to anyone in my wing of the Pentagon.
He turned to look back to the west and walked over to where the two soldiers who had been lugging heavy backpacks had already shucked off their loads and were pulling them open.
But in a few minutes, we'll find out the real truth of it all.
Bob leaned over, pointed to the west, both of the men nodding, and as John watched, they began to unfold and open up a couple of portable dishes and several other antennas. They then pulled out of their packs a couple of high-grade military laptops and turned them on while the other trooper, squatting down, secured the dishes, aimed them west, and began to slowly adjust them while listening to directions from his companion with the computers hooked into the antenna arrays. Bob walked away and came back to the rest of the group.
I thought about Site R off and on after the day, even asked about it. All I ever got back from the government in Bluemont was blank stares and what I sensed were bullshit answers. The so-called reconstituted government at Bluemont was hunkered down in the FEMA fallback position and was told that was it. I just let it go since it was obviously a don't-ask-and-we-won't-tell type of issue, but there were whispered rumors. And then yesterday your friend, Linda Franklin, handed me some data.
He looked off to the west.
And if confirmed, my friends, the shit is about to hit the fan big time.
He walked over to where his eavesdropping team members were still at work. One of them looked up at the general.
A few more minutes, sir.
Bob, obviously agitated, turned back to John and his friends.
Bluemont was a more recently constructed site, actually the headquarters, not for the military in the event of a catastrophic attack, but for a civilian agency, FEMA. Not as big a facility by a long shot. Could house 400 or 500 at most, but a lot more up-to-date. Half the distance as well to D.C. for evacuation. Rumor was it was the parking place for whenever there was a ceremonial gathering in D.C., a member of the cabinet, a representative from each house, and some administrators were sent there just in case something really bad happened. So Bluemont seemed the logical place for those that were able to be extracted out after the attack to set up the government and start over. Also,
he paused for a moment and then shrugged as if the topic were no longer a secret.
There were rumors that some personnel were already up in Bluemont on the day we were attacked, taking part in some sort of drill. Those allegedly lucky ones thus became the core of the reconstituted government. At least that is how I saw it all until Linda tossed those papers in my lap last night with emails leaking back and forth between Bluemont and Site R.
His features reddened slightly.
Some juicy tidbits for this old guy, if not for how deadly it all is. I could almost laugh with how pathetic that guy is.